And you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. This is Mother's Day. We have just been listening to Johnny Taylor's Last $2. And joining me on the line from Toronto, Canada, is Tiki Mercury Clark. And Tiki Mercury Clark has a great CD out called Lift Every Voice and Sing, The Roots of Gospel Music. And Tiki Mercury Clark is based in Toronto, Canada. She was born in Toronto, Canada. She's African, and we're going to be speaking about Mother's Day. And how are you doing, Tiki?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing, Norman?
Oh, I'm wonderful. Now, today is a very special day for mothers, and you are a mother, and
yes,
all of us came from mothers somewhere, and I would like for you to discuss, I guess, your mother and your grandmother and what it was like growing up in Ontario, Toronto, Ontario.
Ooh, okay. That's kind of a tall order, but
you can rise to the challenge, I know.
Well, my mother and both my mother and grandmother were, I think, anyways, extraordinary women. Had very different experiences, but both of them had to rise to the same challenges here in Toronto. My grandmother, my mother's mother I'm talking about, was born in Jamaica. And I wish I could tell you when, but I can't.
Understand.
She kept her birth date a really closely guarded secret. We couldn't find any documents after she transitioned that told us a month or day or year. She took it to the grave with her. And as a matter of fact, the gravestone has date of birth, and it's blank. And it has a date of death. So there was nothing. So we're not really sure. She came up sometime after the First World War. Came up very young. We do know that she came up because she had had typhoid fever, and the doctors had told her to get out of the climate.
Right.
She came up to be with a sister who was already here, who we later found it wasn't really her sister, but a lot of that used to go on in those days. Her sister in the sense of, you know, how we Africans will adopt people and have connections and what have you.
Right.
So she was up, and at some point laid eyes on my grandfather and decided that that was going to be her man. So it took a few years, but that's why she ended up staying. So she ended up going to high school here. She was young enough to go to high school.
What high school did she go into Toronto for those people who live in Toronto?
Pardon?
I said, what high school did she attend in? Don't tell me she went to Central Tech.
Central Tech? Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was around that long. She went to Central Tech. And meanwhile, the man that she fixed her eyes on was a little bit old, quite a bit older than her. And he had been originally from St. Vincent.
St. Vincent is that's the home of, that's what Gonzalez is now, right? Yeah, Ralph Gonzalez, the Prime Minister,
mm-hmm.
Right, okay.
Mm-hmm. And he came up to the United States and was living in the United States. He actually had studied at Tuskegee Institute under Booker T. Washington. He went to New York Pilgrim College. He had two post-secondary degrees, which is kind of rare in those days.
Yeah, right.
You know, at a time when, you know, most folks hadn't even graduated from high school. So, and either black or white. He was a traveling minister.
He was a Mercury.
He was the Mercury, yes.
Okay, all right.
George Luther Mercury.
Okay. And well, your grandmother, what was her maiden name?
Gladys Smith.
Smith, okay.
Yes, yeah. The Smiths out of around Mandeville in Jamaica. And he spoke out against being involved in the First World War, which even though the United States government at one point didn't particularly want black folks as soldiers in the war. They also did not tolerate people speaking out against the war. My grandfather spoke out against it, refused to go to war, refused, you know, and because of that, they jailed him. So when he got out of jail, because he still wouldn't behave himself, you know, according to their perspective, he left and came up to Canada. That's how he ended up coming into Canada.
Okay.
He was a minister, eventually affiliated with the British Methodist Episcopal Church.
The BME.
The BME, yes.
Right, okay.
One of the three indigenous black churches, the other two being the First Baptist and the African Methodist Episcopal.
Right.
The British Methodist Episcopal actually broke off from the African Methodist Episcopal going back to when people had to decide whether they wanted to be loyal to the colonizers from Britain or loyal to the colonizers from the U.S., right?
Right.
So they had a BME church. My grandmother, of course, is very active in the church, she came from a well-to-do family, one of the families in Jamaica that had a lot of land, a lot of servants, and was, I imagine, a very interesting journey to come from that environment and then come here, where the only work that she could get is the very work she didn't do back home. So she had to work as, you know, as a housekeeper, as a maid, as a, you know, all the domestic things that African women have to do. Yeah, doing in a long time. But that was part of the deal of coming here and starting a new life. And, of course, back then it's not like it is now, you know, where people come from various parts of the world, but particularly the Caribbean, which is, depending on where you live, you know, not too long a flight away. And people come and they nowadays and they will go back every year, 2 years, 3 years, what have you. You can keep contact with people much easier through modern communications.
Correct.
Back then, when you came, you came. You know, you came and you grafted into the current community. So they were, they put themselves right into the indigenous black community, most of them Africans who have been here for a number of generations. Although there are some differences, you found a lot of people who were supporters of Marcus Garvey and my grandparents. Many of them from more direct Caribbean descent, and those have been here for a very long time. But there was not the identification with a particular island the way there is now, and there is more of a sort of a pan-West Indian view of the world.
And well, they came there before so-called independence came to the
exactly.
Caribbean. That might have something to do with it, don't you think?
Absolutely, absolutely. And there was a lot of movement amongst all the islands. My grandfather had gone to a number of different Caribbean islands before getting into the United States, even. So there just wasn't that sense of, you know, this is the island and this is the borders and this is my, you know, little dot on the ocean. So it was a different kind of attitude. But they came and they forged ahead. And this is at a time when racism was quite overt here in Toronto.
Right.
When I was growing up here, it was quite overt. You often don't hear about that because, of course, we don't hear our history from our words. We don't hear history from our perspective and people whose families have been here that long. And speak very honestly. I was impressed even as a girl quite often how one thing would be said when we were amongst ourselves and something else said altogether if there were white people present or we were amongst white people. And then, of course, I understand that part of that is because there was a great danger in being very open and honest about racism. But my grandmother had to do a lot of resistance work, let's put it that way. And one of the ways that was far-reaching, I guess for lack of a better expression. And it has to do with a system that many of us still are having to deal with, and that's educational system. My mother wanted to be a nurse. And they had just opened up nursing to black women. And it was a new field that she wanted to get into. So she was going from grade 8 at Ord Street School in downtown Toronto. She wanted to go to Harvard Collegiate because she needed to go to a collegiate to get to the kinds of subjects that would allow you to then go to nursing college. So when she told her guidance counselor, that she wanted to go to Harvard and become a nurse, she was just laughed to scorn. And the man actually said that, there were no colored nurses, which is the word they use then.
Colored, that's the term that we were,
there were no colored nurses.
And right.
So she showed him, things that said, no, they have opened up, a couple of schools have opened up, and he was very discouraging and, in fact, quite derisive about the idea and told her that you people make really good cooks. So we're going to send you to Central Tech, which is where my grandmother had gone to school. Right. So fortunately, because my grandmother had gone to school here, she knew the rules. She knew what could be forced on someone and what could not and what you could resist. So she paid a little trip to that guidance teacher, and I can't really tell you what was said in the office, but my mother did go to Harvard Collegiate. She graduated with honors, and she went on to study nursing at Whitby Psychiatric Hospital, which was the only local one, I think, at the time, that actually would take black students. So she was not the first, not the very first, but part of the initial vanguard of black women who opened up nursing to our community. Which
I don't want to cut you, but wasn't nursing the first thing that African women did in terms of numbers? Didn't other than being housekeepers, the nurses, was that a big profession for black women in Toronto at one point?
In terms of profession, I would think so. Yeah, I would think so. Of course, there were some things that opened up because of the war and because so many men being away. But
right.
A lot of that was a factory work. But in terms of a profession, I would think so.
I didn't want to cut you. Continue. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So my mother did eventually become a nurse. Now, there was one other black woman in her whole group of women who were going through that year. And she kept in contact with some of her other pals, right? And it was still an ongoing fight. A lot of times our community, especially our younger people, will read about how, okay, so she succeeded, she got out, she became a nurse, and that was that. She started working right away. But that's not the way things actually go about changing. She had to wait 3 years before she could actually get a job as a nurse, for someone to actually hire her. And the conditions that she often had to work under, the assaults and the name calling, and it was actually dangerous, and to a certain extent those elements are still there, but of course it was much worse in those days. So when you really look at it, you have to appreciate that her fellow students who came out of the same course had 3 years seniority on her, simply because they're privileged in being white,
right.
But she was active in the unions, and
she was in the union at that time.
Yeah, she was. As soon as there was a possibility for any kind of unionization, she was part of it, and she.
Now that is kind of extraordinary too, because unions in North America, not just in the United States, but I imagine it may have even been worse in Canada for a black person trying to be a part of the union, I believe, because I just came from an event where they honored Bromley Armstrong, who was a trade unionist here. But could you elaborate on that union piece again? Yeah.
I actually can't, because if I knew then what I know now, I would have questioned more so about her union activities. This was things that were happening when I was a child.
Right.
So I would just hear bits and pieces, and I really don't know. And then when I really got to an age where I could pick her brains more, I was actually working so much on the road myself.
Right.
You know, that we didn't have those conversations. And that's, unfortunately, sometimes when I talk to people and they'll ask about my parents, and both my parents have transitioned, and I'll describe myself as an orphan, and they kind of chuckle, because we think of that only in terms of little kids. But you really realize as you get older that, you need your parents for a lot longer than this particular culture wants to admit, or maybe they don't need it as much. We African people definitely need our parents around a lot longer. There's questions that will start to come up when you get into your 40s and 50s and 60s that doesn't even occur to you when you're younger. And if your parents aren't there, it leaves a gap in the continuation of knowledge. My mother died very young in 1994. She's only 63.
I reunite exactly. I unite with what you're saying, because my father died when he was 48. I was 21, and there's certain things that I want to know. So it's your interview, but I agree with you completely.
Yeah. Adult orphan. There's still,
right.
That thing there. But my mother was a fighter, and my mother ended up replaying the same game, or the same story, I guess, just taking on a different role, as happened when she was a child. When I was in grade 8, at the time, I was doing some articles and had a semi-regular column with Contrast Newspaper.
Contrast was could you explain what Contrast was?
Contrast Newspaper was a black community newspaper owned and edited by, well, not edited, but owned by, published by Al Hamilton, another African-Canadian who actually had come from out west. And it was the first really national black newspaper that we had. And it was, in fact, it was international, because the subscriptions did go into the United States and into the Caribbean and in Africa and Europe. It was a very strong activist newspaper. They would take on issues and corporations and governments and advocating on our behalf. Right? So some people saw it as very militant. It really wasn't. It was just very outspoken at a time when too many people thought that if you smiled and were really polite and asked really nicely and begged really nicely and long enough, that you could get some kind of equitable treatment.
Right.
And Al Hamilton's view was, no, you got to demand it. You got to shout it. And if you got to shame them, then so be it. You know. So I was writing for him. I had wanted to be a writer. I had wanted to be a writer for a long time. And in grade 8, when my guidance teacher asked me what I wanted to be, I told him, well, I want to continue with what I'm doing. I want to be a writer. And after he picked himself up from the floor from laughing, he said, there are no Negro writers. My mother got colored, but I got Negro.
You weren't colored. You at least advanced a little bit, right?
Yeah, progression, yeah. So I said, what do you mean? And I started naming off writers, Leroy Bennett Jr. and Richard Wright and Zora Neale Hurston. And he waved his hands and dismissed it. I never heard of those people, but you people make really good hairdressers. So I'm going to send you to Danforth Tech, right?
Mm-hmm.
So here we go, a generation later. my mother coming to the school, repeating the role her mother had, right, on my behalf. Okay? And again, I don't know what was said in the office, but I was able to go to a collegiate. And as you know, I continued writing, and I used my writing skills as part of my work, an integral part of my work. So my mother was actually having to repeatedly cite in the educational system. So although I didn't see what she was doing in terms of unions, my mother was so much of a shero to me because I saw her actively coming to schools and having to fight on my behalf, and she did that without hesitation, and she did it, you know, with no holds barred. And this was at a time when, I mean, it just, things were very overt. I remember when I was in grade five, I had a teacher. To give you an idea of where this teacher was coming from, we had transferred from another school district because we moved. And so we actually came into this school district, is the one that where Riverdale is now, an area called Riverdale, which is somewhat, not posh, but a nice middle-class area in Toronto. And we came in November. So because the school year had already started, the classroom had already started, I was brought up to the classroom I was assigned to by a class monitor. So the teacher didn't see me until I was at the front door of her classroom, right, having been brought up from the office. And she took one look at me and she said, "Oh God, a nigger." And that was my introduction to my grade five class. And that kind of thing was not that unusual back then in Toronto. And people are very surprised to hear that. You know, they're surprised to hear things like, you were pretty well guaranteed if you were on a subway or streetcar or bus that if you were sitting at a double seat, it didn't matter how crowded the vehicle became, you would not get anyone to sit beside you. We used to make jokes about it, about, you know, riding and comfort. but it was amazing. And I mean, sometimes you'd have white people come right out and say things like, "You should be in the back." You know, if you're a kid, they would poke you, spit at you, and all kinds of things like that. So in the school, getting back to this one particular case I'm thinking of, in the school, I had become sick. This was after the Christmas break, and I had become sick, and I asked to go down to the nurse's office. And the teacher refused me, and because I kept asking, she became angry, and she said that I now have a detention because I kept asking. Her reasoning, because she told the class, was that those people are always playing lazy and playing sick to get out of doing work. So to make a long story short, I ended up collapsing. I passed out at my desk. The teacher woke me up at 4 o'clock. The school day ended at 3:30. My detention was till 4. I hadn't even realized that it happened because I'd passed out the whole afternoon.
So you could have you could have passed out and not woke up.
Yeah, exactly. She pushed me awake. I stood up. I tried to stand up, and I fell down. I had taken off my shoes. My feet were so swollen I couldn't get my feet back in my shoes, and I actually collapsed on the floor of the classroom. And I remember vaguely seeing the teacher's shoes come over to where I was laying. She took that same poker she had woke me up with and poked me a few times, and then she walked back up to the front of the class, and then we used to have cloakrooms behind the slate of the row of blackboards. She put on her coat and her hat and her boot, and she left. And she walked out of that school. I was up on the second floor. She walked out. She walked past my brother, who was waiting at the door, because neither of us would go to or from school alone, because we were always getting physically attacked, because we were one of the first black families to move into that area, and people didn't want us living there. So she walked out and left me there unconscious on the floor. My brother came in and saw me and ran and got the principal, who was still there. The principal came up and saw me, left me there, and ran downstairs to call my mother to ask what he wanted, what she wanted to do. Are you going to come and get your daughter? Do you want me to call an ambulance? It sounds bizarre, but this is what happened. So my mother came barreling over in a cab and ran upstairs and picked me up and carried me downstairs to a cab and brought me home. And I was off school for almost 2 months.
2 months.
Very, very seriously ill. They thought I had rheumatic fever. It turns out it wasn't. I now know it was fibromyalgia and the beginnings of arthritis. But I was quite delirious for some time with a very high fever, and I was quite ill. And that teacher, I mean, she later had to deal with my mother, which was very unpleasant for her. And marks that she had been denying me, I had restored to me. And that kind of thing went on constantly. I had to have my mother. My mother was constantly having to run, protectively for me against the school system that was intent on doing its best to break me down and destroy me. And she had to do that for her boys as well. I have two brothers. So a very active, proud tradition runs in our family with our women.
Well, I hate to say this, but we are going to have to get off this phone because we have about 5 minutes left. And I think that this is a story that I know listeners would, we can continue this at another time with your permission.
Sure.
Okay, but we wanted to, we're going to, first of all, I wanted to thank Sandy Thompson for handling the technical aspects of Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. And the last, we're going to play Mahalia Jackson. You requested Mahalia Jackson's I Come to the Garden Alone. And could you talk about
it? It was both my mother and grandmother's, one of their favorite songs.
Okay, what kind of impact did Mahalia Jackson, why was Mahalia Jackson, you think, why did black people, I shouldn't say black people, why did African people and people all over the world, like Mahalia went to India and all over and was accepted everywhere. I have a beautiful CD that she made in England. Why do you think she was so popular?
Well, she had an extraordinary presence and voice, and she channeled that spirit, basically the ongoing spirit of life that animates that we've all come out of. And that is an essential part of African music. It's an essential part of gospel music. People mistakenly think that the religion of Christianity is what puts the spirit in gospel music. And that's not true.
It's not.
It's African spirit that is with us, is part of our DNA that we put into whatever music we come up with.
Right.
And that translates to everyone because it's the same spirit that enlivens everyone. It's just not everyone culturally expresses it the same way, or I think has as focused use of it that we have access to. Because part of that also is related to melanin, and we'd have to get into another conversation for that.
Well, let us listen to. Thank you for this interview, and let us listen to. You can introduce it.
This is a song called In the Garden. It's being sung by the incomparable Mahalia Jackson, one of my musical heroes. It's a well-loved song by my mother and grandmother, and it was one that often would give them strength and energy to continue their good fight.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.